Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Repeal and Replace show. We know it has been several weeks now, but we cannot resist saluting the Repeal and Replace effort for the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare.
I was just glad I got an invite to this one.
Yeah, well, the effort was there. We just weren't successful. We did not have maybe the leadership necessary.
You didn't get the votes you needed?
That's a good way to put it. Listen, thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and with us to discuss repealing, replacing, and many other things from the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program, Assistant Professor Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And despite the best political efforts and intense lobbying.
The minority whip.
Yeah. To explain to you about Health Matters on the Internet from the University of Kentucky, Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know we can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. That's right. Again, we say it every week. Moorhead State Public Radio does have a website. You can go there. You can find a page that's devoted to Health Matters. There you will see all of the most recent shows in summary form. But most importantly, there's a link there. Click on the link, listen to the show, send the link to your friends, promote Health Matters through the audio portion, which is, again, found at WMKY.org.
Our sponsor for the show is Breast Cancer Screening Guidelines, reminding you, you screen, I screen, we all screen for breast cancer. There's a couple of sources for this. I'm going to start with the American Journal of Medicine. This was a commentary from Vinay Prasad, who's at the Division of Hematology and Oncology at the Knight Cancer Institute, Oregon Health Science University at Portland, talking about the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force mammogram screening guidelines. They've issued some newer guidelines, and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has in the July issue of Obstetrics and Gynecology did the new guidelines. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has had these guidelines for a while. First of all, the extent of the problem. In 2015, 230,000 women diagnosed with breast cancer, 40,000 women died of breast cancer. Outcomes strongly related to how far the cancer has spread when you find it. If it is confined to the breast and the armpit, those lymph nodes that are there in the armpit, that's potentially curable. You can use some combination of radiation, surgery, chemotherapy, and hormone therapy to try to modify the cancers, and you can cure that. Once it gets beyond the lymph nodes in the armpit, that is metastatic, and we can control it. We can induce remissions, but it is very difficult to cure, if not impossible to cure, after it's spread beyond. So that's an important thing. Mammography, accepted as a standard screening tool. Annual rate. Now, here's the problem with mammography, just in a nutshell. Since we introduced mammography in the United States, the incidence of early breast cancer has doubled. We are finding twice as many early cancers. So, therefore, we should find half as many late cancers because we're finding it early. Instead, we find twice as many early cancers and only 8% less late cancers. So, in fact, there are more breast cancers now, a lot of them early, but still more breast cancers, and we're not having that big impact on late breast cancers. The concern then is, what are we diagnosing? Maybe we are diagnosing some stuff that before we did mammograms was not going to be a late-stage breast cancer anyway, and we are diagnosing things that aren't really threatening, life-threatening to women. Now, it's hard to say. This looks like a cancer. The biopsy looks like a cancer, but I bet it won't do anything bad to you. Why don't we leave it alone? We don't have that ability. So the question is, well, can we control the mammograms so that we don't bother people with things that aren't cancerous? Are we willing to do that? And it is very difficult to say, well, let's just not look because probably we won't find anything. Based on modeling, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force researchers concluded that every other year screening among women who are age 50 to 74 is estimated to reduce their risk of cancer mortality by 25% over their lifetime. 7 breast cancer deaths averted per 1,000 women. You screen 1,000 women for 24 years, and you will save 7 of them from dying of breast cancer. You drop it down to age 40 and go once a year, you would avert 3 additional deaths, but you would have 2,000 more false positives, 11 more diagnoses per 1,000, and so forth. So the more we screen, the younger we screen, the more frequently we screen, the more problems we run into this. We may find a few more life-threatening cancers. We're going to create a lot more problems for people, more diagnosis, more surgery, and possibly more complications. Now, looking at all these numbers, Swiss Medical Board, this is in Switzerland. They are the Swiss Medical Board. They decided that the advantages of mammograms have been overstressed. The net harms outweigh the benefits, and they have decided not to recommend screening mammograms in Switzerland at all. It depends on which trials you look at and which you feel are high quality. Should we have followed people longer? Should we have screened more people more often? What about the newer technology? Is that better than the older technology and so forth? Our problem is now in the United States, there's no way we could say, all right, half of these women don't get a mammogram at all and half of them get a mammogram and let's see what happens. We've got to look at this old data and make some interpretation, and there's where our problem is.
What about self-breast exam?
Yeah, you know, self-breast examination, once again, why would you not do that? It's absolutely free. You can do your own examination. The problem is when you find the lumpiness and bumpiness of the breast and you take that into your doctor, you know, it sort of starts a chain of events, as you know. As a physician, I will tell you, if a woman comes to me and says, I think I found something, there's no way I'm not going to refer that person on for a biopsy. I'm not going to say, oh, it's probably just a bump. You found it. You should know your breast better than any physician should. And so if you find something, I'm going to take it seriously. And this is the problem. We don't seem to have a way to there's no way to watch these lesions. Once you find them, you got to do something with them. And it's frustrating. Anyway, to wrap this up halfway into the segment, I'll just tell you the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, June 23rd, said women at average risk for breast cancer, no family history, no first-degree relatives, average risk, offered screening mammograms starting at age 40 and start no later than age 50. Average risk women should have mammograms every 1 to 2 years until age 75. After that, let's talk about it and see. That's their recommendations, and that's still a more aggressive recommendation than the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. More about that next fractional portion. We start off with brain freeze, and this is a good topic to talk about in July. It is pretty hot out there right now, and it's already August as soon as this show airs, so yeah. We could talk about it in July, but it's August, so why don't we talk about it in August? There is something called the sphenopalatine ganglion. This is a group of nerves in the back of the top of your mouth. And this thing, if you freeze it, that's what causes brain freeze. That causes those symptoms. Stephanie Vertrees at Texas A&M, there was a press release on this. She said, if you stimulate with cold food, they can give you a sensation of a headache. Now, the interesting thing about this sphenopalatine ganglion is it also, we think, triggers migraines and cluster headaches. So Vertrees says, and I did not know this. Tell me if you knew this, Shelley. Tell me if you knew this, Rick. Many people will try to give themselves a brain freeze to break a migraine headache.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. But, you know, I've knock on wood, I've been lucky my entire life, and I don't know that I've ever single time in my life had a migraine.
I used to get migraines, and it never occurred to me to give myself brain freeze.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've had a lot of trouble understanding migraines. We used to think that it was about the blood vessels getting big and small. The blood vessels would constrict, and you would get this strange visual symptoms or maybe an abnormal smell. We call that the aura. And then they would dilate, and you would get this pounding headache. Now, migraine headaches are not just bad headaches. They are a specific type of headache, a pounding headache that often occurs after this aura. And I was taught they were vascular. I was taught, you know, well, you could use blood pressure medicines to maybe slow down the rates of migraines. But they appear to originate from this ganglion, this group of nerves that's in the back of your mouth. Now, Dr. Vertrees points out this doesn't work for everybody, and it won't work every time. But it is one way, obviously a very inexpensive way, to treat a migraine, to try to give yourself brain freeze. Now, the other part of this thing on brain freeze is to realize, first of all, brain freeze, I hope everybody knows this, is not life-threatening. It feels life-threatening. I mean, it feels pretty bad, but it's not life-threatening. And they say, you know, well, you know how to avoid brain freeze. I mean, this is a doctor giving advice on a national press release, says, eat your cold food more slowly than you eat your warm food. I just talked last week about burning my tongue on coffee, and if I eat ice cream and I eat a big bunch of ice cream, it'll or a slushy, that can give me some problems. It says, well, eat it slowly. Keep the food in the front of your mouth. The farther back you go with cold food, the more likely you already hit this group of nerves in the upper part of your mouth. So there's how to avoid it. If you feel it coming on, press your tongue on the roof of your mouth. The heat from your tongue will warm up the sinuses behind your nose, and that will warm up the ganglion. That's theoretically true, but keep in mind that tongue you're pressing on the roof of your mouth has also been iced down by the slushy or the ice cream you got, and so it's not a terribly effective warming agent. I'm thinking at this time.
Mm-hmm. That's when you get a drink of that hot coffee.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a simple way to do this. You drink some lukewarm drinks or something like that, and that'll take care of it. I haven't had brain freeze in a while. You just go slow and
well,
you're fine.
You're not old enough now to really, really love ice cream, right?
Well,
so, I mean, I'm still old at heart. I love ice cream.
And you're young at heart.
Yeah, well, no, I'm
old at heart.
No, we talk on the show all the time how older people like ice cream.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And so I am old at heart in the fact that I love ice cream the way an old person loves ice cream.
I once made an observation as a physician that if my patients in their 80s gained weight, it was almost always due to ice cream. Most of the older people I know have more flavors of ice cream in their freezer right now than they did when they were in their 40s and 50s. My mother specifically has 6 different flavors of ice cream. I checked her freezer last time I visited. She got 6 flavors of ice cream. I will tell you, when we were growing up, if we had Neapolitan, that was a good day.
Nice.
You remember Neapolitan, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, yep. Why do you think they call it Neapolitan? Is there something...
You want me to Google it and find out? Because I guarantee you there's an answer.
I know there's an answer. I don't have that, but at any rate. Yeah, well, actually, why don't you Google it? Because we're going to talk about smartphones. Rick, by the way, is not using a smartphone. He's using an actual
computer. I've got 3 or 4 devices here.
Yeah, he's over there. That's why he never says anything, because he's all there busy.
I talked about all kinds of things.
You posted on Facebook, Rick. Come on.
Somebody's got to do it.
Okay. Last thing, very quickly. This was an analysis by Change Healthcare. Out of $3 trillion in medical claims submitted by hospitals in the U.S., 10% of charges, $262 billion denied. The insurance company said, we're not paying it. You and your doctor say, I think I would like to have this test. Doctor says, I think that would be a good idea. Let's get the test. Your insurance company says, no way. 9% of total charges. Now, 2/3 of the time, they'll reverse, but the cost for getting them to reverse costs our system around $8.6 billion. It is one way insurance companies use to try to hold down their costs is they just deny stuff, and you have to go through an appeals process, and it wears you out, and it makes you worry as a doctor or as a patient about whether or not you can that test will be covered. And it costs the system $262 billion in denied claims and about $8.6 to appeal those claims and reverse about 2/3 of them. We're going to reverse ourselves and take a break. Why don't you get some ice cream? Keep it in the front of your mouth, please, and come back for our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for NSPR Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Repeal and Replace show. We are saluting our political leaders and their bold and innovative efforts to reform our healthcare system. It's hard to say that with a straight face, isn't it? I mean, Honestly, someone needs to grow up. And it's not Rick. For once, it's not
Thank
Rick.
You. Who are you and what have you done with my co-host?
He's had brain freeze.
Did you?
That's right. Permanent brain freeze. Our sponsor, Breast Cancer Screening Guidelines. You screen, I screen, we all screen for breast cancer. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists published their guidelines. Now, I talked about the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force guidelines. U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends every other year, beginning at age 50, consider at age 40. This is what the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says. Women should be offered screening mammography beginning at age 40. If they don't screen in their 40s, they should start at age 50. The decision on when to begin screening should follow a discussion of the potential benefits and harms of screening. What are the harms of screening? Well, you find something. And in a substantial percentage of women, you're going to find a thing. It's very rare for a woman to go a decade or two decades of yearly screenings and not find something that is going to need further attention. It might need an additional X-ray. In many cases, it'll need a biopsy. That biopsy itself makes a person feel anxious. It also can cause some harm, but that's pretty rare. The problem is right now we are finding too many. It sounds odd. We're finding too many things we're calling early cancers. We don't seem to be reducing the late cancers, and so some of those things apparently weren't going to become a late cancer. And so we've gotten ourselves into a mess with our screening. This is one of the things that we look at with prostate cancer screening. Prostate cancer has a 99% five-year survival. So how are we going to screen for something and make the survival better than 99%? That's hard to do. And the same way, breast cancer has an 89% five-year survival. Is that because we're finding it early? Is that because we've gotten better chemotherapy? It depends on how you look at the studies. Unfortunately, we can't go back and repeat those studies with modern technology because there's no way in the United States a woman could be advised not to have mammography for a randomized trial. So, in effect, we've got to look back at this old data back before women got mammograms and try to figure out what changed. Some people think it's the mammogram. Some, to be honest, don't. So there's the risk and benefits we talked about. The screening should occur every 1 or 2 years, says the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Screening every 2 years, especially ages 55 and older, is reasonable. Screen until at least age 75 if a person is in good health. After that, what are your preferences? What other illnesses do you have? How long, and this sounds tough, but how long do we expect that you will live? We don't want to be doing screening on a person who has something else that's going to limit their life expectancy. In that case, we're wasting their time and money with all these biopsies and screens. That is our sponsor, Breast Cancer Screening Guidelines. And Shelley, I know that's you're personally affected by that as well as your patient. What you're thinking about screening in the 40s? How do you recommend?
Well, I follow the guidelines, so 1 to 2 years. So talk about it with the patient. I've had one every year since I was 39. So,
do you have a family history of breast cancer?
Nope.
Okay. So you would be considered at average risk?
Yes.
Okay. Next up, Rick, you're going to love this, so you should probably pay attention.
Okay.
All right. Adrian Ward, assistant professor at Macomb School of Business, University of Texas, Austin, 2 studies. 800 undergraduate students, average age 21s. And they had them take a test. They're going to do a test of their cognitive capacity. This was one of those reason tests and so forth. It takes an hour. 520 of them in the first study, age 21 years average. And they assigned them to one of 3 groups, depending on what they did with their cell phone. First group, they left the cell phone in the next room with all their other belongings. They went in and they took their test without their cell phone in the room. There was a group called the desk group where they took the test and they put their phone face down on the desk beside them.
Okay.
And then there was the pocket or bag group. They carried their belongings in the room. They kept their phones either in their pockets or in their bags. They completed 2 tests designed to measure your cognitive capacity. If you want to know them, they're the automatic operation span test, the O-span test, and a 10-item subset of Raven standard progressive matrices. These are tests, again, that just test cognitive capacity. Now,
can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Do you find anything interesting about the 3 groups? Is there any group not accounted for?
the group that don't have cell phones.
Right.
Right. All these kids. Think about it.
800 college kids, and they're not even making the attempt to suggest one of them might not have a cell phone.
And Mr.
Think about that.
And Mr. UK network person, you think that's accurate?
I totally agree. But I think it's think about where we were 10 years ago or even 20 years ago. 20 years ago was amazing. There was no such thing as a cell phone, really. And 10 years ago, they were a flip phone and your parents had them.
And you remember, I mean, the first ones were, they were like an Army field unit.
Well, yeah, they were a bag with a battery. I mean, you had to have a battery big enough to support it. But I find things like that, Tony, I find them fascinating. We're doing research now that doesn't even fathom, doesn't even account for 0.1% of the people don't have the technology.
I agree. And, you know, and you're old enough, and I'm old enough to remember that you call up, hey, Mom, guess where I'm calling you from? Like this I got one of these new cell phones. You call from Commonwealth Stadium.
I've called, yeah.
You call somebody specifically from Commonwealth Stadium to tell them that you were at Commonwealth Stadium. That was what we used to do.
I wasn't a Commonwealth Stadium guy when I was younger.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm at the Grand Canyon or, you know, something different. But, cool. Yeah. Mostly Vegas.
All right. Thanks for that. Participants also completed a test requiring mathematical calculation and a questionnaire about their experiences in the lab and their beliefs about the connection between smartphones and performance. Here's the interesting thing. The people that kept their smartphone in the other room performed better than those who had the phone on their desk. Now, they weren't talking on the phone. They just simply had the phone there beside them on their desk.
Right.
And the group in the pocket bag group, they were in the middle. So if you're trying to take a test, a test of cognitive function, you will do better if your phone is in the other room. There was they asked them, they said, were you thinking about your phone? And there was no, they were not. None of them. They were concentrating on the test. But for some reason, when the phone is sitting there beside them on the desk, they did worse on the test. They went back. They got an additional 275 undergraduates. Again, their average age was around 21.3 years. And they did the same experiment, except this time they had them turn the phone off.
Ooh.
So it's not going to vibrate. It's not going to ding or anything else. It's just going to be off. And they got the exact same results. If you leave your phone in the other room and it's not anywhere near you, you will do better on the test than if you put it in your bag, and you would do significantly better than if you have the phone sitting on the desk beside you, even turned upside down. Power on, power off didn't make any difference. Now, what they think is happening is, even though these people are not actively thinking about their phones, and they mention the people who check their phone the most often were the ones who got the worst scores. They had the biggest spread in their scores.
Right.
So this is what the researcher said, and I'm quoting, ironically, the more consumers depend on their phone, the more they seem to suffer from its presence. Or more optimistically, the more they may stand to benefit from the phone's absence. So apparently, you know, just seeing the phone there, especially if you're prone to check your phone often, in the test, something happens. Your brain says, maybe I should check the phone. You don't know it. You don't tell the test guy, yeah, I just kept thinking I should be checking my phone. But your brain suddenly pulls itself back from the test. This is their theory. And says, what about the phone? And you say, no, I'm taking the test. So they just have to periodically just pull back and then start again rather than diving into the test.
Totally agree. I can totally see that. I mean, Tony, I remember the first time I went on a cruise ship. And the cruise ships back when we first started going didn't have internet connection. They didn't have cellular. They didn't have any. I mean, so you essentially became a technology orphan, right? I mean, you couldn't use it. And so at the time, you know, all of us techies, that's, you know, we don't know how to look up. We always look down at our phone. And so separating myself from the phone was an interesting thing. That was one of the first vacations I'd been on where there wasn't Wi-Fi. There wasn't. And I would catch myself at dinner going, where's my phone? And it would be distracting. So I can certainly see how it would cause somebody taking a test. Now, I think once you've left another room, You'll do that one or two times, but then you won't do it anymore because you'll realize it's not there and you'll forget about it. But when it's right there, you can't forget about it.
Now imagine then, I mean, but if you think about the way these students carry the phone, they take it with them when they study.
Of course.
That phone is always there.
Give it 10 years and you'll be allowed to use your phone to study. Because, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, it's like a calculator. Where calculator is to math, Google is to knowledge, right? I mean, so at some point, you'll be able to use the collective knowledge of man in a searchable format like Google to help you solve problems.
But you yourself, the price you pay apparently is you cannot focus and concentrate as well. You're always wondering if somebody's going to call you.
Well, I think it's worse than that. I think, you know, there's a chemical that's released when you get a text message. I think we've proven that when the thing dings or pops or does something, it releases something in you that gives you a sense of happiness, right? I can text you, Tony, and make you – well, you may be a little different.
Oh, dear God. It's another
you're
one.
You're a little different.
I'm different from you. I mean, I'm different when I get something from you. I'm perfectly fine at getting texts. My daughter gives me a text. That's a nice thing.
And so what I'm saying – but I am convinced, though, that – and good or bad, I think the attention span – you know, we call it ADHD, but really our attention spans have just gotten shorter because of phones, because of technology. We continue to shrink. We can't stay focused. I have a hard time sitting down reading a novel. I have to force myself to read more than 5 or 6 pages because I become disinterested. I become distracted.
What about cat videos, focus. Right? You could say, gee whiz, chapter 3. Oh, what about a cat video? Isn't it about time for a cat video?
The difference in you and I is about 10 years.
And probably 500,000 cat videos. But I understand. This is really kind of scary research. When you think you got something there that and they did some observation on the student. And you know this, as you mentioned, Rick, that there is it's rare to see people – pretty much as soon as whatever is happening stops happening, people pull out their phones and check them.
Exactly.
And I will see that. You know, you sit down at the restaurant.
I checked
and
it after you stopped, after I stopped talking and
right,
you talked.
Check your phone.
I checked.
And if you go to the restaurant, you sit down. Everybody pulls out their phone to see what's happened since they came in the restaurant and that sort of thing. So you've got this thing that interferes with your concentration and you carry it with you everywhere you go. And you set it, and particularly you set it beside you when you're trying to concentrate. The research is kind of disturbing, and it makes you think about how these devices are affecting us. Yes, we have access to knowledge. The problem is we are not able to concentrate and not able to think. So we have the knowledge. For instance, during the break, Rick confirmed that Neapolitan, in fact, was a dessert named after Naples.
Right.
The Neapolitan people made this dessert.
And they brought it with them to the U.S.
Yeah, a tricolor dessert, Italian flag. I suppose they had green in it. I believe Italian flags got green. Mm-hmm. They had green ice cream once. Our Neapolitan was always chocolate, vanilla, strawberry. Which, Shelley, you said that leads to a sequence.
Uh-huh. Chocolate, strawberry, vanilla.
Yeah, that's the way you eat it. Nobody eats the vanilla. So you eat basically these long stripes in the Neapolitan box. It was an awful ice cream. And my family, who rarely had anything more than Neapolitan, my mother now has 6 different flavors of ice cream in her freezer.
But if you were a kid and you liked vanilla, there was always vanilla for you. Right?
You were that guy. Yeah.
It always was there.
My dad liked vanilla ice cream. My dad,
I like
you, give
ice
it a choice.
Cream.
Somebody says, what kind of ice cream do you want, Dad? We're at Baskin Robbins, 31 flavors. Dad says, do you have vanilla? I'll just let that sink in. You young people don't realize that. You know, I mean, you're.
Try it.
But my dad, given choices, he would have vanilla. And it baffled me. I, of course, was quite cosmopolitan. I would have strawberry, for instance. Because I knew from the Neapolitan that strawberry was more tasty than vanilla. But that's another story. Rick, here's the thing that bothers you in this next study up. This is what keeps Rick up at night. July 5th, this was BMJ. It used to be British Medical Journal, just like KFC used to be Kentucky Fried Chicken. Now they call it BMJ. Children with higher IQs are likely to live longer than those with lower IQs. And, Rick, I'm sorry to bring this up. I know this is a sore spot with you. They did 75,000 Scottish children born in 1936. took the IQ test at age 11, and they followed them for 68 years. You can do that in Scotland. They looked before.
That means never mind.
Yeah, they took it at age 11. They followed them for 68 years, and they figured out, well, who has died before age 79 and of what? They found they were able to confirm the cause of death for 25,000 of the 75,000 kids, a third of them. And they looked at causes of death, cancer, dementia, digestive disease, heart disease, respiratory disease, stroke, so forth. They tried to control for socioeconomic standing. That is, they tried to match these kids, adults now, up and to people that had a similar status in life. The people at age 11 who scored in the top 10% on the intelligence test were 66% less likely to have died from respiratory diseases by age 79 than the bottom 10%. The top 10% were half as likely to have died from digestive diseases, heart disease, smoking-related cancers, stroke, and injuries. And also a link, not as strong, between higher intelligence and lower risk of dying of dementia. We don't know why this is, says the senior author of the study. Lifestyle, education, genetics may all play a part. I think, to me, the mammoth part of this is cigarette smoking.
Right. Soon to be marijuana smoking.
Yeah. You know, here's some rules of thumb, just coming out of Health Matters. Anything that temporarily dulls your brain has a potential to permanently dull your brain. Last week we talked about alcohol. It is really, and we know general anesthesia seems to have an effect. Concussions. The idea that you can take something that temporarily dulls your brain and just walk away from it and not have any effects, that is a risk I'm not willing to take personally. I believe that whatever temporarily dulls your brain permanently dulls your brain. The other thing is, if you set fire to something and put it in your mouth, that's not going to be a good outcome.
Yeah.
And again, just generally, I don't care what it is, what additives, what company makes it, whether you roll it yourself, organic, non-organic, setting fire to things and putting them in your mouth is not going to have a great outcome. Mm-hmm. And so when you put those two things together, and the other thing, we know, we've done these studies in the United States, people with lower educational levels, and that's not the same as lower IQ. We've got to be careful about that. But the people with lower educational levels are much more likely to smoke. In Kentucky, 48.6% of people with high school education smoke, 10% of people with college education smoke. So you put that into this IQ study, and to me, it's going to just to tip everything. Now they mentioned, well, smoking could be certainly could play a role. And I believe if this were replicated in Kentucky, West Virginia, in our area, smoking was absolutely the reason. And to me, it makes it a non-study. But, okay, kind of interesting, I guess.
Yeah, it could be better choices in general. Could be they take lower risks.
Yeah, I would say if you have a higher IQ, possibly you're less likely to do something stupid and get hurt.
You think?
Well, I don't know. I'm not saying I have a high IQ, but I'm very good at doing stupid stuff.
You know. Actually, Tony, I suspect your IQ is probably above average.
I think so. And yet, and so, I think my stupid my ability to do stupid stuff. I mean, I got this farm. I got a tractor. I've got logging equipment. I've got all sorts of things that I can do stupid stuff with.
And have.
Yeah, and have. I put the tractor in a farm pond 3 times.
Well, yeah, but that's better than your brother. I mean, we know the story.
Back to my brother. Now, for those of you who haven't been lifelong Health Matters fans, my brother got a tractor stuck up in a tree. That's absolutely true. I don't want to bore you with the details, but he did get a tractor stuck up in a tree. So that's our baseline in our family. Our family.
Who might add, probably has a high IQ too.
My brothers are both reasonably intelligent people, but this is the sort of family I come from. This is the level of stupid I come from, which is why I so much appreciate Health
Matters.
Are
you from Ireland? Or Scotland.
I appreciate you as well, but I've got to let you take a break. We're going to take a break ourselves and come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Repeal and Replace Show. Our solution.
That says enough.
Yeah, I guess it is. I'll just leave it at that. Our sponsor for the final time, Breast Cancer Screening Guidelines. You screen, I screen. We all screen for breast cancer. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists on June 23rd I'm sorry, in the July issue. It came out June 23rd, but it was the July issue of Obstetrics and Gynecology. They published their guidelines for average risk women. Now, average risk means that you do not have a mother or a sister who has breast cancer. You do not have the BRCA gene, the American College of Obstetricians. If you are an average risk person, do not have the BRCA gene, do not have a family history, this is what they recommend. They used to say average risk women start annual mammograms at age 40. This is what they say now. Offer the screening mammogram at age 40. You don't have to take it at 40, but if you're the kind of person that worries a lot about breast cancer, you want to try to stay on top of this, you don't mind possibly getting a biopsy. I mean, it's going to happen. I mean, nobody is thrilled about it, but that's a risk you're willing to take. If you don't mind those things, if you really are impressed with breast cancer screening and worried about developing a breast cancer, then you start at age 40. If not, everybody should start by age 50. The decision to when to begin should follow a discussion of the benefits and harms. And again, the harms, especially if you are younger. These breast cancers can occur and grow rapidly. It's not that the mammograms pick up every one of them. You can have a normal mammogram. You can have breast cancer. It can grow and spread because, especially at a young age, it can grow rapidly. Secondly, you have these lumps and bumps, and you wind up seeing stuff on mammograms. You're worried a lot, and you have to get biopsies in your 40s, and that's really – that's annoying. But regardless, they recommend you start at age 50 doing it because they feel that the benefits there outweigh the risk. Screening every 1 to 2 years, depending on, again, on your preference. Every 2 years for women age 55 and older is reasonable, according to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Screen at least till age 75. Stop screening if a person has a limited life expectancy or other illnesses that would make it more difficult. Clinical breast exam offered to women ages 25 to 39 every 1 to 3 years and annually at age 40 can be offered. Now, there's no proof that clinical breast exam lowers your risk of cancer, but it can be offered. The other thing, the breast self-exam, not recommended in an average risk woman by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecology. Instead, breast self-awareness. Rather than routinely examining your breasts, you should be focusing on noticing a new pain, a new lump, a new discharge, a new area of redness, and you should tell your physician immediately if such findings occur. Those are the new breast cancer guidelines, and you screen, I screen, we all screen for breast cancer if it is appropriate after discussing the risk and benefits. Now, keep in mind, in not every country do they feel that the benefits outweigh the risk. The Swiss have decided, no, we've looked at the data, and we think that a lot of these changes you see in terms of breast cancer mortality are related to better treatments rather than screening. It depends. You will see heated arguments over this from experts, depending on which research studies they believe. Everybody is looking at old research with older technology because we can't do a trial now and tell half the women in the clinical trial, you're not getting mammograms. That would be considered unethical, even though we're not sure how much help they are. It's a strange situation we find ourselves in, but these are the guidelines, the best knowledge, according to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecology. Next up, got a couple of things. We were talking about people with higher IQs living longer. Pointed out that if you just park a smartphone next to a smart guy, apparently you can dumb them down.
Yeah,
so you can take care of that whole. If you're worried that your brother or sister is smarter than you, just ask them to leave the smartphone next to them, and apparently you will be able to concentrate as well as they will. This has been an ongoing. Now it's been a year. And I picked this up from a group called the Advisory Board, but the journal Nature. A year ago, a guy named, I'm sure I'll mispronounce this because I don't understand it. His name was Jan Vige. The last name is V-I-J-G. Now, what kind of a human being has a last name of V-I-J-G? Vige.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like you just can't stop saying his last name and then you fall down the stairs or something. Well, I'm sure he has trouble with Weaver, but I think it's a more sensible name. This was published in Journal Nature. He said what he did was pretty interesting. He took the longevity records for 41 countries and looked at all of the countries every year who was the oldest person in that country. The oldest age worldwide in 1968 was 111. By the 1990s, we were regularly seeing people who were 115 years old. There was one woman in 1997, Jean Calme, I guess, 122. Certified, actual, documented, 122. But the average age was up around 115 for the oldest person in the world in the 1990s. The chances of someone somewhere in the world living over 125 in any given year, less than 1 in 10,000. So it would be, I guess, 10,000 years before every 10,000 years we'd have a person live to age 125 if we kept our current conditions current, which obviously wouldn't happen. So he said, okay, based on this data, the way we've plotted it from the 1960s, 41 different countries looked at this oldest human beings, humans will never get older than 115. Albert Einstein College of Medicine, John Vigdg, says never more than 115. Four articles, actually six articles, but four main points in the journal Nature said we disagree. One, the big argument, there's three big arguments. One, that's not enough people. You take the oldest person from these countries, you got a handful of people. And you can't make any sense of those trends. The other one says, look, same thing. With those data points, we could just say it continues to go up. You think you've got a plateau. I can draw another line that seems to continue to rise. We think it could go – we could get up to over 120. And the other thing, looking at only the oldest person who died doesn't really – can't give us a lot about life expectancy. I like this. This was University of Illinois Chicago, Jay Olshansky. Sorry, Olshansky. Sounds like old Shansky, but it's Olshansky. He says, look, the takeaway is it doesn't matter how long you're going to live, 115, 118, 120. We should make ourselves – we should try to extend the period of healthy life. We spend so much of our time in search of absolute numbers of life. Frankly, you know, and Jelly, you've seen it. I've seen it. When you get to extreme old age, the quality of life is not the best. And it is very difficult, I think, to be happy past 100. It's possible, certainly possible. And there are those people who possess their mental faculties and reasonable physical health. But obviously, as you get into your upper 80s and 90s, there's a lot of people who wind up with chronic pain, with severe limitations, physical and mental. And so their point is, if we can get most of those people from age 80 to age 90 in a healthy situation, we could do more good worldwide than trying to push 115 for a handful of people.
Mm-hmm. I agree. It's more about the quality.
It seems to be, when we look at people who live to 100, it seems to be a lot about genetics. That it's you know, you can adopt a healthy lifestyle, you can eat vegetables and so forth, and you can extend your life. And again, the thing we were talking about is lower your risk of disability and so forth. But if you want to be 100, you should maybe choose different parents. Be the best way to do it. All right. So you're okay with that, Rick?
Or just drink more coffee.
Lots of coffee. Rick's 40 ounce K cups are just even the beginning. If you can get that down for breakfast, then you're off to a good start, a daily start, right?
Something like that. I can't help it.
Well, quite simply, you could do it with chocolate chip cookies. If you eat a chocolate chip cookie every day for 100 years, you're going to live to be 100.
Well, I'll die happy.
Yeah. I mean, you die happy, but you know, you at least you have a plan. That'd be my plan to get 100. Just eat a chocolate chip cookie every day for 100 years.
Then if that's the case, then
and
I'm
so
going to...
So far, so good.
Well, if that's the case, I'm going to plan to buy some size 15 shoes so that I can go ahead and play in the NBA. Right?
I'll be there to cheer you on or laugh at you or take photographs. I'm not sure which.
Yeah, I hear you. Such a friend. Turn back around.
Just a couple of things here. This was something called Becker's Hospital Review, July 18th. And these are different healthcare groups talking about the BCRA failure. Again, Better Care Reconciliation Act. That was after the America's Healthcare Act, which was supposed to replace the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. All these, as of the time we are recording this show, all of these are historical. Other than the Affordable Care Act, the two Republican plans are, in fact, only historical oddities. But American Medical Association says the debate over health care reform is ongoing. A collaborative process must commence among lawmakers that produces a bipartisan approach to improve health care. Status quo is unacceptable. You know, and so he stresses bipartisan. The American Hospital Association president and CEO Rick Pollack, he says, the consistent call from the American Hospital Association is grounded in the belief that coverage must be preserved. So we got bipartisan action. We've got preserve coverage. Now, that's if you were to divide that up politically, I think everyone's for bipartisanship as long as the other people come over to my side.
Right.
Preserving coverage is that is essentially – I think the Republicans are coming around to it. It's a Democratic idea. It is very, very, very hard, and I think the Republicans underestimate how hard it is to roll back an entitlement. That is, the government provides something, and now it's going to stop providing that thing. First of all, you can't reset the clock to 2004 or the calendar to 2004 and simply go back to that state. Hospitals, healthcare systems, and patients have adapted to the new reality. But then secondly, you're going to have a difficult time getting votes for reducing government benefits. The Association of American Medical Colleges, the president and CEO Darrell Kirsch, says repeal must be accompanied by a simultaneous replacement that provides at least comparable coverage. So again, I've got two organizations in favor of coverage, of maintaining coverage, one talking about bipartisanship. America's Essential Hospitals president, Bruce Siegel, said, we hope lawmakers seize on this opportunity to bring all stakeholders to the table and develop a plan to protect coverage. He's going bipartisan and coverage. Physicians for Reproductive Health board chair, I don't know why he weighs in, but he did. It's time to cease efforts to destroy what is literally a lifeline for millions of Americans. Stop inventing ways to deny people the right to affordable, comprehensive health care. Catholic Health Association of the United States says strongly urge you to start anew in an open dialogue and bipartisan effort. So, you know, these organizations uniformly are calling for bipartisan efforts and for finding a way to protect the coverage that has been provided under the Affordable Care Act.
I think the type of coverage makes a difference too. You know, if we focus more on prevention and making better choices and raising kids with healthier habits, that could go a long way.
Yeah, you know, my friend Yule Scott is an avid campaigner for universal health care, and health care is a right. That is, coverage is... it's really a tricky word. I think it in a sense, it diverts our attention from the problem. Right now, we could have universal coverage. I could say, all right, you give me a dollar and I will cover the first dollar of your health care expenses, and that's coverage. It doesn't mean anything. You're still going to have to pay for your health care, but you have a plan and you have a policy. And unfortunately, with really high deductible plans and high copays, we more or less say that. Yes, you have coverage, but you still will go bankrupt if you get sick. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea of preserving coverage is a bit of a smokescreen. What we really want is to provide health care. When you're sick, you have health care that's affordable. And coverage is not the same as affordable health care. Coverage just simply means you have some type of policy. We could write a policy that's so bad that you could cover everybody with it, but it really wouldn't matter. So I'm bothered, I guess, by the idea that the idea is to protect coverage. I see in the free clinic, and you see with me, Shelley, every day, people who have coverage but still can't afford their medicines,
right.
Can't afford their tests.
It's meaningless coverage.
Yeah. So I'm less protecting coverage and find a way to try to get health care out to more people. But I agree with the other part of it, the bipartisan. I am firmly convinced that neither party is going to solve this. Just thinking, just saying. Rick, do I have time?
You got like 1 minute.
1 minute. Updated recommendations on colorectal cancer screening. The Multi-Society, this was a group of the American College of Gastroenterology, the Gastroenterological Association, gastrointestinal. This is a bunch of GI doctors, essentially. June 23rd, they said, all right, here's what we think about screening for cancer. Should begin at age 50 in non-African-American patients, age 45 in African-American patients. That's a weak recommendation. The evidence is not strong there. You should offer screening tests, different options, colonoscopy every 10 years, fecal immunochemical testing, testing for a chemical every year. That's those are your first tier. If you decline that, get a CAT scan of the colon, they say, or this fecal testing every 3 years, or a flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 to 10 years. If you decline all those tests, maybe use the capsule where you swallow it and it looks at your colon. That's a very weak recommendation, not much evidence. And there's no evidence that a blood test will screen for colon cancer. There's also no evidence that this show should remain on the air. Rick?
Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Sean Delaney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is used with a proper diet and exercise program and possibly with other radio shows to control high blood sugar. Nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, weakness, or a metallic taste in the mouth may occur. If any of these effects persist or worsen, tell your doctor or pharmacist promptly.
Health Matters can rarely cause a serious and sometimes fatal condition called lactic acidosis. Stop listening to Health Matters and get medical attention right away if you develop any of the following symptoms of lactic acidosis: unusual tiredness, dizziness, severe drowsiness, chills, cold skin, muscle pain, slow heartbeat, or stomach pain with nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea.
Read the patient information leaflet, if available, from your pharmacist before you start listening to our show, and each time there is a break. If you have any questions, consult your doctor or pharmacist.
Tell your doctor immediately if any of these conditions occur or if you notice a big change in your overall health. You may need to stop listening to our show temporarily. The elderly are also at higher risk, especially those older than 80 years who have not had kidney tests.
Health Matters does not usually cause low blood sugar. However, low blood sugar may occur if our show is prescribed with any other anti-diabetic radio shows.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get up this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.